Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And is the Arab world in the midst of a historic reawakening or just a reshuffling of who wields power? Are Kerry and Obama getting it right in the Mideast now on America's interests and what we say are our values? Marwan Mawasha is with us now, formerly Jordan's foreign minister, deputy prime minister, and ambassador to the United States, now vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment. His new book is The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. Ambassador Mawasha, thank you very much for coming back on The Brian Lehrer Show. Good morning.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So the term Arab Awakening refers to a historical period in the Arab world in the 19th century. Can you start with a quick history lesson for everybody about what that was?
That started as an intellectual movement in the mid-19th century of people who wanted to get rid of Ottoman rule and then of colonial rule. That first second awakening did result later on in popular movements that got rid of independence. What I argue is that it stopped at that, and that post-independence, no Arab country has given serious attention to putting in place democratic institutions that would ensure, you know, a culture of pluralism. And I argue that if the Second Arab Awakening is to be finally successful, it has to go beyond getting rid of despotic rule and putting in place the necessary pillars for a democratic society.
If you're looking at this as a battle for pluralism, as your subtitle says, who really wants pluralism in the Arab world? Maybe the young professionals in the original Tahrir Square protest 4 years ago, but the Islamists want everything their way. The Egyptian military wants it all their way. In Syria, many ethnic or political factions just want things their own way. I realize I'm oversimplifying, but does pluralism as a value have any real constituency in the turmoil today other than a few intellectuals?
I don't think you are oversimplifying. I think that the old forces in the Arab world, both the secular and the religious forces, have been terribly unpluralistic, as we have seen in Egypt, as we have seen elsewhere in the Arab world. And that is why I believe that the real hope lies with the new generation, not because age is a determinant necessarily or young age is a determinant of pluralistic values, but I think it is because the young generation has enough of a critical mass that does indeed believe in a pluralistic society. I also think that pluralism and democracy, you know, has no shortcuts. It is not going to emerge overnight, and it is going to require hard work through decades of paying attention to things like the educational systems of the Arab world, to put in place a culture that respects diversity and regards it as a strength.
You said a minute ago, and I saw it in the book too, that the first Arab awakening was begun by intellectuals and trickled down to popular movements. We tend to dismiss that kind of progression today, don't we, as elitism rather than grassroots, never mind that it often doesn't work when intellectuals start something.
Grassroots work is very important, but I think it also needs to be within an intellectual framework. The first Arab Awakening started as an intellectual movement, later made its way into a popular movement. The second Arab Awakening so far has popular movements that started as, you know, revolts against despotic rule, but so far they have been much more able to tell us what they are against rather than what they are for. That program of the future and what it should entail has still not been contextualized intellectually, if you want. My book tries to be a contribution towards that goal, but it is also a call of arms of some sort to tell people that democratic societies will not come about by wishful thinking. They do require decades of work before they come about.
Marwan Mawasha, my guest, former deputy prime minister and foreign minister from Jordan, now the author of The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. And listeners, Arabs from anywhere, is a second Arab awakening underway right now, or is it just a reshuffling of who holds power? Do you want pluralism in the Arab world, and how can it be brought about? 212-433-WNYC. And what do you want the U.S. to do? Help in certain ways? just butt out already? What? 212-433-WNYC. Anyone may call, but first priority if you're an immigrant from any Arab country or just of Arab descent, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What about the United States? You suggest that the U.S., Europe, Israel, and the Arab governments themselves all reacted badly to the uprisings of recent years. Each of those has a different set of interests. Where do you start with the United States, and what would you like to see it do today to encourage pluralism?
I think the United States has for a long time prioritized stability over reform in the Arab world, took sides, chose dictators to support, and did not pay much attention to the issue of domestic challenges facing these countries in the region. Where I do believe that this is an indigenous process that needs to take, needs to be homegrown and needs to evolve over time, in which the international community role is important but largely marginal to the process, Brian. I think what the United States can do from this point on is to support the process but not to pick winners and choosers, not to pick individuals or groups it wants to talk to and not talk to others, and let the process evolve on its own. That's the best, in my view, recipe, is just to do no harm and to support the process of democratization without supporting individuals.
I want to repeat, because I think it's important, and just from my own perspective and understanding of the decades that people have lived through and of recent history, that it's one of America's biggest failures of the last century, and even President Bush admitted it in maybe the best speech of his presidency in 2003. The U.S. supported Arab dictators for 60 years after World War II if they would sell us cheap oil, take our side in the Cold War, and fight radical Islam, our common enemy. That was a total sellout of our stated values of 1776, of spreading democracy and standing for democracy and self-determination. In my own opinion, that was a huge root cause of 9/11, not to defend the al-Qaeda murderers in any way, but a huge root cause. Do you see it that way? And are we on a different road now with our president and his anticipatory Nobel Peace Prize?
I do see it this way, Brian. I also would add that the United States' failure, if you will, to affect a successful peace process that would bring about an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict has been an added also reason why the United States today is not held in high esteem in the Arab world. So when President Bush talked about that failure and attempted through, big brother techniques to impose a reform process from the outside, it did not work, partly because the United States' credibility was at an all-time low. Having said that, as I said, I think a new beginning has to realize that this process is largely indigenous, but where the United States can at least do no harm and stop supporting individuals in the region.
The Arab-Israeli conflict, is Kerry tilting at windmills with his quest for peace right now?
It is very hard to criticize any effort to bring about peace to the Middle East. However, I think that as genuine and serious as Secretary Kerry is, I did not agree with the whole process of incrementalism, if you will, which has not worked over 20 years. It has exhausted its possibilities. We today know what the solution is. The problem is not finding a solution, but finding a credible path to get us there. And I think it is time for the United States, with the help of the international community, to put a package on the table for both sides. But to expect both sides on their own to bridge the gap and to come to a solution anytime soon, I think is wishful thinking. We are approaching a time, if not already, when a two-state solution has become almost impossible to implement with the numbers of settlers in the West Bank and Gaza. And we need to understand, I think, that time from now on is not on the side of peace. And the more time, the more time we give the process, the less of a chance we have to have a two-state solution.
Does that mean you want John Kerry to stand up there tomorrow at a podium with a lot of reporters from around the world and say, okay, here's the Kerry plan for Israeli-Palestinian peace?
Yes, except that it won't be a Kerry plan because it would be the result of 20 years of negotiations between the two sides. We today know what the plan is. President Clinton knew what the plan was 12 years ago, more, 14 years ago when he was in power and suggested the Clinton parameters. So it's not a secret. It's not something that people are going to pull out of a hat. The parameters of a solution are known. What would be a solution that would meet the minimum needs of both sides? Right. What is needed is the political will.
And I hear this from guest after guest with roots in the Middle East, that the details of an Israeli-Palestinian peace are completely known if only the two sides would have the courage to make the sacrifices each would have to make. 1967 borders with some land swaps, no right of return, shared Jerusalem. I could do the whole usual list. So mm-hmm. should I conclude that both the Israelis and Palestinians are actually happier with the status quo than the deal we all know is there to be had because the compromises remain politically untenable after all these decades of mutual suffering and distrust?
I wouldn't use the term happier, but I think the Israeli side is not ready yet, particularly this government, not all of Israelis, but this coalition government is not ready to make the ideological decisions needed to bring about a viable two-state solution.
What's the hardest part of that is moving
Jerusalem?
Settlers off the land?
Well, no, that's part of it. Jerusalem is East Jerusalem, a shared Jerusalem that is open, but that would really serve as the capital of two states. I don't think that the Israeli side is ready to do this. The Jordan Valley today is a new requirement that Israel has presented. And then there is the issue of Israel as a Jewish state, which has also been a new requirement added to the list of requirements that Israel has.
But then that also means the Palestinian side isn't willing to get off right of return to not just the new Palestine, but to Israel, affecting the demographics there, and to recognize the Jewish state nature of Israel after they separate? I mean, neither side wants to get over those hurdles.
Well, I don't think the right of return necessarily, is a hurdle at the end of the process. In other words, everybody understands that it is impossible to bring back 4 or 5 million Palestinians from the diaspora into Israel. I think you are looking at a package deal where there will be compromises, probably a compromise on Jerusalem on the Israeli side in East Jerusalem in return for an explanation of the right of return that would not, mm-hmm. of course, result in millions of people going back to Israel.
Marwan Mawasha, former deputy prime minister and former foreign minister of Jordan, his new book, The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. And let's take a call. Ahmed in New Brunswick. You're on WNYC. Hello, Ahmed.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Okay.
I wanted to ask you, guest, since most Arab countries are predominantly Muslim, a theocratic thinking, how does he see coexistence between pluralism and Islam?
There is nothing in Islam that is against pluralism. I actually see pluralism as having four components: political pluralism, the right of all political parties to peacefully coexist; religious pluralism, the right of all religions to peacefully coexist; gender equality, total equality between men and women; and cultural pluralism as well. There is nothing in Islam that has prevented pluralism. In fact, religious pluralism existed under this Islamic empire for centuries.
Let's go to David in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Thank you for coming on this morning. I always appreciate these topics, even if I don't always agree with what's said. We keep talking about Arabs. There are so many different classifications of what Arab means. Muslim, Christian, Sunni, Shiite. I've spent many time traveling Israel, the whole of Israel, both the Jewish parts as well as the Palestinian parts. And I've met with Palestinians. And one of my conversations actually brought up a very interesting question. I said to one of the Palestinian women, are you a Christian or a Muslim? And she said, that's an insulting question. She said, I don't appreciate being classified. And I said to her, in all fairness, the only thing that unites Christians and Muslims in Israel is the fact that you have a united affront towards a secondary people. You know,
well, or maybe what unites them is that they're Arabs. We had an Arab, we had a Palestinian Christian on the show the other day from Bethlehem. He is definitely Arab, and he's definitely Christian, and he definitely feels oppressed as a Palestinian. So I'm not sure there's such a...
Well, you know, the Arab world is a very, very diverse culture. Religiously, ethnically, we have Arabs and Kurds and Amazigh. We have Christians and Muslims and Jews. It's a very diverse region. I myself am very much in favor of national identities trumping any sub-identities. And I do agree that being a Christian or a Muslim in the Arab world should be a sub-identity, not the real identity. Otherwise, you know, we're going to just encourage the sectarian divides that we are seeing in places like Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere.
Like the Sunni-Shiite divide, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, whether people are Christians or Muslims, people don't ask in this country whether you are a Jewish American or a Christian American. Being an American always trumps all these other sub-identities.
Right.
That should be the case in the Arab world as well.
And what about Iran? Your book is framed around an Arab awakening. Iran is not Arab, but is such an integral part of the politics of the region.
It is. It's true that Iran is not an Arab country. Many people would argue that Iran had its awakening in 2009 before the Arab awakening started. But the values that my book talks about, pluralism, diversity, respect for different points of view, tolerance, are all values that can apply to Iran as well.
Marwan Mawasha, former deputy foreign minister, former deputy prime minister and former foreign minister of Jordan. His new book is The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, we'll preview Mayor de Blasio's first 100 days speech that he's giving this afternoon and dig into the Al Sharpton FBI story, a rat or a cat. Stay with us.